Birds, people, and the dogs that bring them together. This is episode number 11. My name is Bill, and you're tied to the Woe Post. The past few days, we've done a whole lot of nothing. You know, every spring here in central Indiana, we get about a week or two with, I don't know, maybe like 10 inches of rain or something ridiculous like that. It floods everything. Our roads are flooded out. It's hard to travel. We live way out on a hilltop, so we're safe here. I don't think there's been too much notable damage to people's properties, but it just makes it hard to do just about anything, and that's what we're doing right now. So the best we can do is sit around, be happy, and wait for things to dry out. Once they do, we'll take advantage of it. We'll be getting back out in the field and running dogs. This episode started out about red and white Irish setters. It started out talking about bringing Irish red and white setters back to the United States. We talked a lot about conformation as a quality control measure in breeding and hunting dogs. But it quickly took a turn because this community is not just about the dogs. It's about people, people, and people. It's about the importance of mentorship. And that's what Bob Devlin describes to us over the next 40 or 50 minutes. Bob is the owner of O'Dobelin Kennels. He's a man who's contributed over 50 years to restoring the greatness once found in the Irish red and white setter. And it's about the countless mentors that supported him both in Europe and the United States. It's a great story with a little bit of resiliency and a whole lot of appreciation for the help that others have given us. But first, a little bit about the Irish red and white setter. Irish red and white setters predate most hunting breeds, with a rich history going back to the 1600s. They're known for their exceptional scenting ability and for a low point or a set. But the favor of the rich red coat led to the near extinction of the breed, which was saved only thanks to the commitment of a few dedicated breeders. Red and whites are known for their playful, courageous, and cooperative temperament. Adults range in height from 22.5 to 26 inches and from 35 to 60 pounds. They have a medium-length red and white coat with silky feathering on the backs of the legs, tail, and the ears. Hey, Bob, thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we really start, can you tell me how to pronounce your kennel's name?
It's ancient Gaelic. And it is the Gaelic transition of my Anglo-Saxon name, which is Devlin. And it translates to O'Dobelin, which is O apostrophe and capital D-O-B-H-A-I-L-I-E-N. And when we got into this enterprise with the red and whites, I wanted to honor the fact that we had both ancient Gaelic in our background. Both my wife and I are of very ancient Irish families. Her family's name was O'Halloran, and mine, of course, was O'Dobelin, which is pronounced now the same way as Devlin, but is hardly recognizable in the ancient Gaelic form. It goes back to the 8th century in Ireland.
Some fine Irish names.
That didn't hurt us at all when we were dealing with Mrs. Cuddy and Father Doherty early on to try and convince them we were okay to have a dog or two. You know?
I guess that would help. And so your history with the red and whites goes back to the mid-70s, but you were raising red setters before that. Is that right?
That's correct. In the decade prior to that, I had made a friend out of a lady that was local that was already one of the authorities on the red dog setter in North America. In fact, engineered probably the biggest show win we ever had with the dogs at the Chicago International, which at the time was the second largest dog show in America. Where a bitch dog that we had prepared for some period of time was being shown to an older gentleman that was an all-rounder, and she knew that he was an expert on the movement of red and white, or red setters. And so we brought the dog to him, and sure enough, the finest class of red setters I ever saw in my life, 27 of the best bitches in the breed from all over the world. Hollis Wilson was his name. He pulled me out of line in the middle of that. I had looked at the contestants, and every important handler that I knew of was there. The Cooper family, generations of the best handlers. And I wondered to myself, my God, what am I doing here? And sure enough, Hollis watched us go round and round and round. It didn't stop like they normally do in a show situation. And he, after I don't know how many rotations of watching the dogs move initially, he pulled me, went, did a double take, came over to the middle of the line, pulled me out and put me at number one and gave me the points, the 5-point major win at that point, which was a gigantic accomplishment in red setters. So that was my, some of my experiences with Lucy Jane Myers was the woman's name, and she had devoted her life to red setters at that point. And although she wasn't fortunate enough to have some of the formal background stuff, both in terms of genetics, in terms of study, but she had experiential background that was second to none in that breed. And she had gotten me interested in the breed itself and showing the dog at that point. So I was already on my way to a dual path work at that point, you know, back when I was 26 years old. I had come from a tradition of English Springer Spaniels and Labradors before that. So I had a hunting dog background anyway from my own family that was pretty profound. One of my earliest memories was my parents were breeding black labs when I was coming into the conscious stage at about 3 years old, 4 years old, and we had a litter of black labs on the floor. And I can still remember that to this day, and I'm 82 going on 83 now. So that was my start with dogs. At about an earliest age, you can start.
So back, you know, 50 plus years ago, was it a lot more common to have the dual dog, you know, the bench and field dog? Or when did you start to notice that split, particularly in the setters?
Showing dogs was fairly different, I think, when I first even found out about it. And there was already a great delineation between people who are interested in field activity and those who are interested only in showing dogs. And that was a mistake not made by a lot of European countries at that point. I know that when we first started pursuing the red and whites, and we did so because my wife had insisted that we go and find out in Ireland if that dog even existed anymore. We thought that they may have become totally extinct at that point. And that was when I was about 35 years old. And, you know, that's a long way from being 85 now. But anyway, we went to Ireland specifically to find out if we could find one of these dogs, if they even still existed. And the Irish Kennel Club put us on at that point to Vincent Brennan in Northern Ireland, who eventually supplied us with the first male that we had to import to this country. In fact, two of the best males that I've ever owned in my life, Seamus, first male, and the second dog was Birch, who I already told you the story previously of, and his amazing feat at the hand of our hunting experience in South Dakota with pheasants.
You know, one of the things that really fascinates me between, you know, what you called, you know, the European style of breeding is their focus on form and on structure and the importance of the maintenance there within, you know, each kind of breed standard or breed requirement. I think here in the U.S., a lot of us get focused on a dog can only be a show dog or can only be a field dog. And, you know, everyone who's heard at least one episode of this podcast has probably heard me say that you have to be able to have both, that conformation isn't about pretty dogs. It's about structure and it's about longevity with our hunting partners.
Exactly. And right now, AKC is having a struggle with that whole issue. And when we, and first in Ireland, when we were there, I think our first trip, we went to a dog show in Ireland, and the red dogs and the red and white dogs were being shown in the same classes in as a single breed, which genetically is closer to the truth. Irish people got fascinated with the mahogany color on the dogs at a very early period, before there was much genetic knowledge in the world at all, a couple hundred years ago. And they, of course, did all kinds of experimenting and crossing over in their breeding practices, trying to concentrate the mahogany color in the dog. What they didn't realize is that canines have three times the number of chromosomes that human beings do. And it's in the 70s, to 76 perhaps. But even more important, there's a lot of ancillary genetic characteristics that connect to the transfer of each phenotype production that one gets by breeding those animals. Therefore, it's an immensely frustrating experience for people that don't understand those genetic characteristics, and they get a kind of a random result, not tightly controlled as grandparents stuff is with human beings, with only 23 pairs of chromosomes. And most people leave dog breeding because they have a total lack of understanding of genetic principle, and they don't really understand how that there could be such a divergent set of characteristics that come out of breeding practices. Fortunately, I made the early decision to take a course in genetics at the University of Minnesota in the medical school. And when I was in college, and it became a lifelong fascination of mine thereafter, with some pretty outstanding knowledge. The professor was the Pope's personal consultant on genetic issues at that stage, and also a dear friend and personal knowledge experience with Mrs. Cuddy in Ireland. They knew each other and had tremendous respect for their own abilities. So that was one of the things that I stumbled into later on in my life that turned out to be very fortuitous and very great for me. And it was experience that no one else in this country had ever had. The Irish informed me of that. She said, "You're the only American that ever came to Ireland looking for the red and white that had a formal background in genetics." And that weighed heavily for them in determining to make me their man in America, which she said later on, when they, after 6 years of screening, they finally allowed us to have the first set of brood bitches in our possession that came to us. I think my success with the breed and my joy in the experiences has come because of the wonderful people that I've had a chance to get involved with in that practice and learn so much about not only the history, but the development process of the Red and White Setter. And that's just been a gift from Providence.
There's no putting a price on a good mentor.
Oh, we have had the best in all of my years. We just happened to stumble from one group of the best contacts into the next group of great contacts. You know, people frequently have recently in the last couple of years said, "Oh, we think you're the greatest dog breeder we've ever run across." And that stopped them immediately. I said, "Look, I want you to understand that the greatness in these animals is because of the work of 400 years of wonderful people in Ireland that was very careful about what they were doing. And even with limited information, we were able to make, you know, great decisions." And it's kind of formulated the kind of personalities that we look for in the people that get our dogs. Most of them are hunting persons, and most of them are as interested in the origin and development of the dog as I have been all the years of my life. And they genuinely appreciate that. This happens immensely in the European experience with almost all the people that have the dogs. And it's alien to what people in this country are used to. I remember Mrs. Cuddy at one time said, most people in Ireland look at the people that breed dogs in America as having two big flaws, part of the American character, which is one, excess, and two, speed. And it turns out that she knew more about Americans than I did at that point. I had a tendency to undervalue what she had said until my experience proved to me she was absolutely right on the money. She had us figured out better than I did. But that's another one of my great learning experiences from Father Doherty and Mrs. Cuddy, who had devoted their lives of over half a century to the control and direction of the breeding of these dogs in Ireland. Some people, she pointed out to me, and the countries that were doing it right and the countries that had ignored that experience. And so I was able to track then those countries that were doing it with great finesse and urgency in their work with it. And I benefited from that tremendously, just because of the mentorship of the father and the Mrs. Cuddy.
Now, you mentioned that it was a 6-year kind of a vetting process that they basically put you through.
My God, they talked to half the people that I had known in my life at that point. I'm almost 40 years of age. So they really did a job of screening people and contacting an in-depth pursuit of what I might be doing with the dog in the future. But to them, of course, it was a very, very important thing. And they had devoted their lives to both of them. For all of their lives, and they were very old. But Ms. Cuddy said to me one day, you know, Bob, Father and I aren't going to live forever. And we realized we somehow got to start moving the dog into America before it just becomes a random act. So she said, we decided to put a brood bitch with you for our first option. And I will never forget the feeling that I had at that point. I had presented at World Congress in Amsterdam at that point. And we were flying back, and I said, we better stop and see Mrs. Cuddy, and have agreed that we should. And so we went to Cork and saw Mrs. Cuddy and had tea with her. And we were doing a couple of things at that point. She informed us that they had started the recovery in Ireland of the numbers and the purity of the really good Irish red and white setters that were left. And they had been at that point decimated by the two world wars significantly, because the economies of Ireland during those world wars were drastically cut back. It was difficult for those people to keep well fed and struggling through the war experience in Europe. And of course, the dogs suffered numerically, tremendously from those two experiences. And it was acknowledged that when we did originally get to Ireland and realized that there were some left and that they were being very carefully tutored and held by certain very important dog owners, that this had been the experience, and it was truly an endangered species at that point, at those points. And Mrs. Cuddy and the father had undertaken the chore of reviving that and getting the dogs back prominent because they were so highly thought of. There's an interesting story about a gentleman by the name of Nash, who was very prominent in the history of the dogs. At the time of our Civil War, the red and whites at that point had become very prominent from the late or the early 1700s, and their experience in the field trial activity had become very, very advanced. And they were doing so well and in competition with the Red Dogs at that point in Ireland that the Red Dog fanciers went to the Irish Kennel Club and had the Irish Setter name changed to the Irish Red Setter Club. And of course, the red and white practitioners of field dogs, field activity, and field trials, which were going on in Europe at that point, they got so angry that they decided to withdraw their practice of competing in those events, which, when you think about it, was a very stupid decision, because ever after, the numbers of the dogs began to be depleted, and they became less and less as prominent as the Red Dogs, who already had an incessant beauty title going with them in that rich mahogany field. It was kind of getting to be the world experience in terms of Irish Setters. So they kind of shot themselves in the foot with that activity. And there still is a competition in Ireland today of the Red Dogs versus the Red and White Dogs. But it's done on a much wiser basis, because the knowledge of genetics is far more prominent now than it was historically at that point in history in the mid-1800s. But by the time we got involved in it, everything had been pretty well cast. And the genetic experience of the animal at that point, it became fairly well known. Because they began to realize, holy cats, look at the difference in the genetic stuff that came down with the two dog, with the red and white, largely focused in field activity. And the red dog became more and more prominent as showing experience in this country was on the rise and going up very rapidly. And eventually, when I was with the Red Setter in that decade following my age, 26 to 36, they were the most prominent and popular dog in AKC registrations. So that's how they had grown. And people just began to think that all Irish Setters were just Red Dogs. And they had long ago even gotten rid of the notion that there was such a thing as a red and white dog. We were fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time, and had made inquiry of Father Doherty and Mrs. Cuddy in Ireland. And we then got not only to the shows, but also we began going to the Irish Setter or the European field trials in the Wicklow Mountains outside of Dublin. And I have some interesting stories that occurred to me about that. I think that the second trip that we made to Ireland in the pursuit of the dogs, we went to the field trials and met a wonderful man by the name of Terry O'Leary. Terry had been the president of the Irish Setter activity in Ireland for several years at that point, and was almost a deified treaty to dog people in those years of the history of the breed. And I noticed that the guys had gotten together and were kind of pointing to me and obviously talking about me when we went to the field trials. And one of the fellows came over from this group of handlers, and he said, "We'd like you to be the captain of the guns." And I said, "Boy, that sounds intriguing, but what does it mean?" I had no idea what they were talking about. And he said, "Well, that means you get to, one of the many things that you get to do is to walk with the judge. And he will explain to you what things he's valuing and not valuing in the work of the gun dogs at that point." And there were setters from all over Europe at that field trial. So I got to walk with the judges, and the fellow who came over and introduced himself as the judge. And honest to God, the man was twice my size. I was about 5'8" at that point in my life, the maximum height. And this guy had to be 6 foot or 6'5", something of that nature. And his legs were twice as long as mine. So I told Evan, I said, you better make sure they have a helicopter to get me out of here by the end of the day, because I'll be lucky to survive it. You know?
Those are big steps to keep up with.
Oh, yeah. But the experience was a concentrated course in what field dredges were looking for. And that was an educational part of my development. There's no other way in the world you could have gotten it. And it was because of the kindness of the people that were running the trial and participating as the Irish delegation that they gave me that honor, which historically had been going on for hundreds of years, and I didn't even know what it was. But again, I was favored with good fortune and learned a tremendous amount about the European field trial activity. But that's just one of the many anecdotes that I've just recalled here. Terry is now gone. He passed away this last year. But he became a dear friend of ours, and we were wont to be buying each other the first Guinness when we got to the pubs at night after the dog activity. And Terry was a true friend of ours in work with the Irish Red and White Center. And he, along with some of the other breeders, gave us real positive connections to other European breeders that we now are probably the most prominent practitioner with. Other breeders that have a strong positive feeling about how we're going to deal with the dogs. As a result, we have at today's time, we have setters from the genetic input of at least six other countries in our breeding stock that we've become. I've even developed a whole different attitude about outcrossing and genetically in my days of study of genetics here in this country. So it's been a very profound movement in our breeding experiences with the dog.
And you've actually sent dogs back to Ireland to build up their breeding pool, right?
That's true. As a matter of fact, my wife has done a stellar job of working their way through that, because most countries have now made it very, very difficult to export dogs and fly them here, which you have to do just to get them here. But they've developed practices that they kind of look at their breeds of dog now as some kind of a national treasure, which is admirable, but the mechanics of the system that they developed are really onerous. And we sent the sperm of one of our current dogs. It is an outstanding specimen. He is with my oldest and dearest friend in this country. We've been friends since high school. But he had this wonderful male dog that he showed to a grand championship just this past year. Yeah, and he's doing this. He assures me that he said, you're not getting much credit for what all the hard work that you've done all these years, and I'm going to make sure that they hear about you. And so he's been our emissary out in the show world, of just making sure that he understands that dog was our breeding, and amongst many other really very fine dogs that have been around. And he's doing this only because he wants me to get credit for it. And those are the kinds of friendships that have helped us along the line. Again, fortuitous events that have happened to us that were surprised and unplanned, and other people have just been very kind to us in what we've learned about the breed. As our reputation has been enhanced by some of our friends in the breeding business over there, they are very willing to cooperate and to share the sperm, particularly being sent around. In fact, we just sent sperm back to our dear breeder friend on the west coast of Ireland, for use in her breeding of the red and white setter. And she's one of the most prominent breeders in Ireland now. In fact, was breeder of the year last year, I think. Annie Miller is her name on the west coast of Ireland. And we've known her for years and have become fast friends and spend a part of every trip to Ireland in her delightful stone cottages overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. I could go on and on for how kind she's been to us and then providing us with some of the greatest dogs in Ireland as our breeding program has gone along. And so I'm deeply grateful to her for her help. And she's done a lot with the other breeders in Europe, making sure that they understand who we are and what we're doing and why we're doing it. So that's helped tremendously, too.
As far as I know, I've never heard of any American breeder that has shipped, you know, semen or dogs back to Europe. Of course, we hear about importing dogs all the time, and we all know it, if we haven't done it ourselves, we know somebody who has imported a dog. Perhaps it's my own naivety, but I've never heard of an American breeder actually send our American dog genes back to Europe.
Now you know one. Due to my efforts of my good buddy down in Florida that we've been friends for over half a century. And we got to know each other in high school and actually went on a entertainment binge that nearly ended us up in Hollywood doing recording. But we've been buddies since that time and lifelong friends, and I still consider him one of my dearest friends. And he's my age. So, you know, that's been another one of those. He's just extending himself tremendously. Fortunately, he's a pretty affluent guy, so he's got endless money. But he's going around on the show circuit on our behalf, kind of like a public relations man. You know? it's really fun for us to have. It's one of the other reasons I dearly love this guy. He's wonderful. You know? that's one of those great things that's been enhanced by our activity with the Red and White Setter, and I'm truly appreciative of what he's done.
You don't see a bunch of Irish Red and White Setters out in the field. Can you describe your typical puppy buyer?
People know that if they're going to work with us, they should be hunters, and if they're going to get one of these absolutely phenomenal gun dogs, they fulfill a dog by being a hunter and working on that, and it's paid off for us in the long run. Again, a part of what we learned from our European breeder experiences, it's just plain obvious in the way things like break down. They're not interested in the artificiality of the cosmetics that go along with only show champions. Because we know that there are some of the other dogs that came from Ireland that are third-grade specimens are carrying all kinds of genetic deletions that the breed shouldn't even have, let alone be passed down breeding-wise. But the people in this country are so infatuated with the bench experience that they're deliberately breeding dogs that have serious genetic flaws, and because they don't show on the outside, of course. And people are finding out the hard way that that's one of the reasons that we've been the beneficiary of doing it the European way, is because we have the most extensive training regimen of anybody in the breed, and we test for everything that we possibly can with every puppy that goes out the door. And those that are good enough to get into our breeding program are thoroughly tested and free of those genetic deletions. In fact, one of the proudest accomplishments that we've made is that of the 300 some dogs that we placed, we have received back to us less than those you can count on one hand. And most people are deliriously happy with the relationship they have with the dogs we produced.
Absolutely. And we've got a lot of the tools now to be able to make responsible decisions. We just have to dedicate the time and the resources towards those tools.
That's right. That's right. And I happen to have been in the right place at the right time with the breeding experiences that went along with developing a fine line of dogs. We've been able to, for instance, Mr. Birch, I told you about earlier in our discussion, that was such a magnificent gun dog, was also one of the most gentle, phenomenal pet dogs that live with us. I have two young males that are the spitting image of how that dog comported himself his whole life, that are now, it's like having a reincarnation of these two males that I've got that are, I call them, one we even call Birchie Two. Because he's the second one that came along that had that just phenomenal temperament. So sweet, so affectionate, so concerned and connected with their human that it's just unbelievable. We're trying to key on that as a major component of the fine dogs that are already great hunting dogs and are winning shows across the country. The people that do excessive gen shopping contact us regularly about where we're going to be into show dogs. And then they don't go. They stay away from us because we've had some rather outstanding wins. It was a lady that had won 16 best in breeds in our breed that, and it was crowing in the publications about that. And she came to the Duluth show, which is a good upper medium size show. And I took one of our males down there who beat that dog and she was expecting to be bragging about for 17 wins for the breed title and is known because of his defeat of that other dog, which, by the way, was a fine dog. Nothing wrong with that dog that I was aware of. And it was, had done some outstanding winning. But my boy, Reach, cut her string short. And so that's becoming a kind of a thing. They find out where we were going to show and they stay away from it in the benchery because they get billed, of course, as hunting dogs. That's one of the things that some other breeders have learned to emphasize is that, well, we just have hunting dogs. Well, that's true. They are hunting dogs, but they're also dual champions. And that's a tough thing to compete with, you know. In fact, in Ireland, when we first discovered the dog, they had as a practice up until only recently, and it was in the process of changing, where they trialed the dogs first, and they had to have their field work completed at a good level before they were even allowed to show them. So they didn't get to the show ring until they had proven themselves for what their purpose was, which was to be fine gun dogs. And the Irish Club, for reasons I don't understand, and it used to drive my buddy Terry O'Leary nuts because he complained about it constantly. He was the guy who was head of the club, and they had always insisted that they do the field work first and then show them. But that's changed in later years to the detriment, of course, of the breed, because almost everyone was a guaranteed dual champion and not anymore.
Yeah, the early American dog shows were in the same, you know, English, you know, old English format of, you know, field trial the first day and then confirmation show the second day. And actually setters were usually, based on, you know, my research in the past few weeks, setters were typically the winners of these shows.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess to be fair, true. For the first few shows, there were only pointers and setters in attendance.
Well, as the only guy with a genetic background, one of the things that I realized early on was that the highly desirable characteristics that we all ascribe to the breed standard will come genetically from those dogs with the oldest line of careful breeding. because those characteristics have been set.
Of the 300 or so dogs that you've placed with Holmes, what are some of the standouts in by way of accomplishment or, you know, whatever just comes to your mind?
You know, other than the experiences that I've had myself, I can't really come up with, I would say probably Fiona and Birch were the two finest dogs that I've had, but that's about of my experiences with them. We have produced monumental numbers of champions in the show ring currently. And we've got two or three that have got all the way in field work. But I'm not even aware of some of the things that these guys have done. What we know is that people are monumentally happy to have fewer than half a dozen come back to you in a 30-year career of raising the best dogs in the breed. You know, that makes a giant statement about how successful they are. One of the strange things is that people want these dogs so badly that they're willing. We have a lot of corporate presidents that own these dogs and hunt also. And they actually have places in their office in the city of a place for the dog to be during the day, and they take them to work. And the dogs stay with them in the office. While they're doing their job, those kinds of things are very gratifying to us. And they're also, you know, their whole day is devoted to the activities of their canine buddies in one way or another. And it's delightful to have some of those experiences. And there's, I would say, a great number of those guys that in fact, Tilly, the really fine gun dog that I mentioned earlier in a conversation here, she was owned by a gentleman that unfortunately developed a very virulent form of cross form of cancer, and spent his last day. Every picture we have of him was with the dog curled up on the couch with him. And we took that dog back, and we have Tilly with us, and she's getting the treatment of a queen. We know that. But we want to make sure that that's the case for some. And she's one of the half a dozen that have come back to us. We're trying to do some things to assemble patterns in the breeding programs of people that might make a difference to all breeds. If they did them, they would have less problems with their breed and more fulfillment, you know.
I know I would definitely be interested in getting a copy of that if you end up getting it in print somehow, some way.
Yeah, and I hope I live long enough. I'll owe the doctor. One of the things I can honestly say is that I have a very, very affluent cousin down in Kansas, and he called me the other day, and he's a dear friend of mine, and he loves to hunt and fish and do all kinds of things that we love to do. And he said, "Hey, do you realize?" He said, "You're the first guy in the Devlin family that ever lived into his 80s. I said, "You dummy, what did you have to tell me that for?" But my physicians have recently made me aware of it. So they said, "Look, you got the physiology of a 50-year-old guy, and you're 82. And I said, "If I were you, from now on, I'd make most of my plans for you to get close to 100. So... That's the redefinition of a lot of my investments, et cetera, that I'm working with on currently. I'm liable to be around for a while, you know.
Well, now that you know you've got another 20 years or so, what are your plans for the rest of this year?
Well, I'm going to keep on doing an awful lot of what I can, but I have to realize my own limitations in terms of what I can do in the dog field. They've been after me for. I used to do training for the AKC about our breed for judges, and all those judges have said, "Oh boy, you've got to become a judge with us, and you've shown us things about our breed that I had no idea existed." And hopefully they carry that into their judging process. And I don't want to spend my life going all over the country to dog shows here and there. I just don't want to do that, but I'm catching a lot of flack because I continue to breed increasingly better dogs, and that I can say that comfortably, and there's a lot to prove that. and that makes me feel wonderful. There's a lot of fulfillment in there that we've been able to get some of the things accomplished with the elimination of genetic deletions and the improvement of the strength of some of our hunting experiences with our dogs. And that's a great reason to continue to be active as you can be. And I'm, you know, one of the few guys in their 80s that can hunt in South Dakota for a week and still stand up at the end of the week, you know. And a lot of people can't. So another thing that I've been very fortunate in, I'm finally trying to get fully appreciative of what that might mean for my future. But I know there's some things I'm not going to do and other things that I want to continue to do. You know? I'm very fortunate in so many ways. And I've often thought to myself, the primary thing that I've been fortunate in is the wonderful people who have mentored me in my activity in canines at various points in my life. And I've had a training to do this that you couldn't possibly design because I've had so many good breaks and have come to meet many wonderful people that were very knowledgeable and willing to work with me. Well, that's a gift. That's a gift that not too many men have, you know. But I am appreciative of it. That's one of the things I can say. And it's fun to see some of the things you've worked on for a long time come to fruition, you know, and that's true of anybody in any field.
Bob, that's a great place to wrap it up right there. Recognizing that the people that have helped us, you know, the mentors that have helped us through this process are really what have provided us the success that we've had.
Absolutely. That's the truth. And I know it to be the case with so many other fields. Other than dogs, but they also recognize how important it is in dogs. But I agree that that's one of the most important elements of my life. So again, I've just been so lucky. And if there's anywhere that I can do that for other people, I sure try to do that. You know,
Bob, I can't thank you enough for being on the show. How could people contact you if they want to learn more about your kennel or about Red and White Setters?
Well, we have under both Red and White Setters and also by our kennel name, Oda Valen, which is, and I purposely did that to make it kind of clumsy and a lot of people can't begin to pronounce it. But it's easier for them to remember when they find our web. We've got a good web page that my wife has worked hard on developing and she's done a superb job. So that'll work either way. Either by kennel name or by the name of the breed. There's a connection breed to Red and White Setters for us.
I'll make sure to link it in the show notes.
Yeah, you can ask other Red and White breeders. Most of the breeders are good friends.
Bob, I wish I could express what a blessing it's been to spend this time with you. Do you think you could wrap it up and just give us some closing thoughts?
We're assembling a real interesting group of people in our association, our Breeders Association. And I'm hoping that they'll do the wonderful things in the future of the breed long after I'm gone. And that's important because we have started with a tradition of 400 years of careful breeding of the finest gun dogs that I've ever come across. And I could spend 6 weeks telling you about that, but they're really a real gift to have been presented with, and I'm so appreciative of all of the great people that have helped us out. I'm hoping a little long enough to get that transferred to the next generation. That's all.
Well, I hope you do too, and I want to thank you so much for being on the show and on behalf of bird dog people everywhere. I want to thank you for over 60 years of breeding the best bird dogs that you possibly could.
Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to tell people about Red and White Setters. I'm fortunate to have that too.
I hope you've enjoyed episode number 11 of the Woe Post. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can share it with a friend, leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, or go to patreon.com/thewoepost and become a patron. As always, you can contact me through my website, www.thewopost.com, through Facebook or Instagram at The Wopost, or through email bill@thewopost.com. Stay steady and God bless.